This is the Venturing Angler Podcast. I'm Tim Harden. In this episode, we'll be chatting with Johan Dupries about his time in the Rewa jungle, his new film, The Rewa Rodeo, fly fishing for arapaima, and his art. Let's chat with Johan. Okay, we're here with Johan Dupries, and we're here talking about his new film that's premiering in the Fly Fishing Film Tour called The Rewa Rodeo. This is a podcast that focuses on destinations and unique experiences, and it sounds like you've been having quite the experience for some time down in the jungles of Guyana. So let's first talk about the film. What's this film about?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. The film is it's something that's been really close to my heart for a long time. It's a conservation film, first and foremost, and secondly, it tells a story of this amazing fish that you find in the jungles of Guyana. To summarize, I think it's sort of a story that looks at why the fishing is so good. And it's obviously because of the efforts of the people of Rewa, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But then it's also, you know, how this fishing program has improved their lives as well. So it goes both ways, and it's a really cool in-depth look at what's happened with them.
Great. And so what's the history there with the community? I know there was a film a long time ago about Oliver White and his friends heading down there and seeing what it was all about. That film came out a long time ago. For those who aren't familiar with jungle fish and the whole situation down there, what's that history?
So just a little bit of history with regards to the Rewa Eco Lodge. In 2005, the village of Rewa decided to create this what was initially a birding and wildlife viewing lodge, and it was started up with the help of Conservation International, and then they took initiative to stop killing fish, and they took initiative to start protecting other wildlife, the birds, the otters, everything else. And more or less in 2010, the Indie Fly movement was founded alongside with this fishing program, and both of them they began together. Oliver, along with Matt Brewer and Matt Schilling, they went into the jungle to explore and to see if it is possible to catch fish, the arapaima on fly. So that was in itself something completely new. It was a brand new experience for everybody else. Nobody's done this before. So that was the story behind Jungle Fish. And that was like really the baby steps in creating this well-established eco lodge and fishing program that we have. What's it now? 2020. So it's 10 years down the line.
That's great. And you'd mentioned there had been some conservation efforts, which always suggests a threat. What was the impending threat that might be happening? You mentioned fish killing.
Yeah. So a big part of the village, they had intent to kill fish and to slaughter fish, both for the exotic trade in Brazil. So the arapaima skins have these beautiful scales with red markings on them. And this became a very sought after thing in the Brazilian exotics trade. So fish would be slaughtered and skinned, and these salted skins would then make their way into Brazil. And obviously, these fish are massive. So they're growing up to, 200 pounds. So it feeds a lot of people. So these fish were just getting hammered, and, they're air breathing fish. So every 10 minutes or so, a fish would come up to the surface to breathe air. And this makes them an easy target. They would literally shoot these fish with bow and arrow. Or just when the ponds get low enough in the dry season, fish would, literally be stripped out with big nets. And this really drove the population to the brink of extinction back in that time.
And then were there, you know, other threats with like mining or deforestation or anything like that?
Yes, of course. I mean, Guyana now has a pretty big oil deal with Exxon. And, you know, there's always this kind of thing, you know, all those jungle communities are being threatened by civilization in a sense. We've had problems with mining prospecting happening on the Rewa River, and, you know, they would end up dumping a whole bunch of sludge into the river or leaving trash. And obviously deforestation is a problem. But luckily the location of Rewa Ecolodge, it's so hidden that it's sort of, it was protected from all of that to a very large extent. Other areas surrounding the Rupununi and Rewa area, they are worse affected by this. But luckily for Rewa, it was still fairly well hidden.
And so the idea then is to form a fly fishing lodge, and that's where you've been spending a good bit of your time, and that's the Rewa Eco Lodge. So tell us about this operation.
Yeah, well, the lodge is something that will exist without us, and it will exist without the fishing. I just have to say that in advance, because the people of Rewa drive this lodge almost entirely on their own. They're very successful at taking people on adventures and showing them the wildlife, and they're very prideful about, you know, their heritage and the place that they live. So they love to share this stuff. So that was initially what the lodge was built on. Once Oliver and Matt discovered the possibility of this being a fishing lodge, the product was introduced. And to cut a long story short, there was a lot of training involved. Guides had to be trained, boat drivers had to be trained, pathways had to be cut through the jungle to these ponds in order for us to get boats in. And this has developed into a very well-oiled system. So now they're, you know, able to accommodate 4 anglers at a time, take them to specific ponds when, you know, they know exactly where the water level is going to be, where the fish are. So the knowledge is really with the locals. I'm just fortunate enough to be there to act as a liaison between them and IndieFly and to assist them in whatever they need. So I'm just going to carry on, you know, with my role at Rewa. I'm there as IndieFly representative. So basically the idea is that I support the local community and I try and help them with anticipation of needs, planning, scheduling, booking clients, you know, making sure the flights are booked properly, making sure they, you know, they don't overspend on certain things, because obviously, you know, budgeting and planning is something that's quite foreign to them. Whereas the fishing and the, you know, showing of their culture and heritage comes very easily, the logistics and the smaller things are a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, I think, I think it's easy for people to misunderstand, but a misconception, I think, with IndieFly projects is that there are a group of folks who are coming in to take advantage of, or not even just take advantage, but to utilize the needs of a community to create a shared business opportunity. But that's not what this is at all. No. IndieFly projects are entirely given over to the communities at each destination.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, IndieFly is a nonprofit organization. So whatever bookings happen, whatever clients come to Rewa, all that revenue goes directly into Rewa. And they're the custodians of their own money. IndieFly is simply there to guide them and teach them how to use that money effectively and responsibly. And I think that's a really cool thing for us. You know, Matt and I often have this discussion, you know, at what point are we going to take our hands off the steering wheel and say, listen, this is yours. And I think we're getting close to it. And it's exciting, you know, to be able to say maybe within the next couple of years, Rewa will be completely independent. And that's an exciting prospect. I mean, that's absolutely the goal. for IndieFly.
That's pretty exciting. And you've been able to spend a ton of time down there, huh? How much time have you been spending down in that rainforest?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't spent that much time, not as much as I would want to. I've had two seasons at Rewa, a couple of months at a time. But before me, Matt Brewer had put in probably 8 years of work. So he's been there a lot longer than I have. So I've been very fortunate to come in to this jungle with people that are very well versed in having outside person living with them. So that's been awesome. It's been great just to learn the culture and to see how they operate. And they've been an incredibly welcoming group of people. Yeah, it's very humbling, and I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
Hey, what you described sounds to me like a lot of time down there. So surely you've had some good experiences.
Yeah, some great stuff.
Have you been able to fish much?
Unfortunately, I have not been able to fish that much. As with any guide will tell you that you don't fish as much as you want to. But every now and again, the stars will align and you'll have one client on a boat, or somebody will pass you a rod and say, hey, have a go. And then it's just about making it count, you know, which is something that I've done fairly well. So yeah, luckily I've been able to catch an arapaima.
The people, you know, I do work with IndieFly too, and everyone always describes this ecosystem as being special. What for you makes it so special?
Well, if we're talking purely about the ecosystem, I think the cool thing is how the fishing is able to happen. You know, these arapaima are pretty much impossible to catch if they're in the river system itself. But what happens is in the wet season, the jungle will flood and these arapaima will migrate into the ponds. You know, they've got a very high tolerance to low oxygenated water, and they can feed on sense, you know, on vibration and such. And that makes them able, you know, enables them to live in these murky ponds. And as the water recedes out the jungle, they kind of get trapped in these ponds. And this is when we get a shot of them. And I think that's a really special thing. It's not your typical jungle fishing experience where you're chasing after Dorado on a river or you're sight fishing. It's completely opposite to what I've been used to and exposed to.
And I guess I just realized now we should describe arapaima a little bit more to people. You did with their scales.
Yeah.
They do have these magnificent scales that sort of resemble tarpon, but they've got these red tips sometimes. But these fish are also like tarpon in size. You know, they can be hundreds of pounds, and you mentioned they can handle low oxygenated water. And so that leads to some strange evolutionary and behavioral characteristics of these fish. Tell us about arapaima and oxygen, and I think you know where I'm putting it.
So, you know, if I have to describe arapaima to somebody who's never seen one, it's kind of I would say it's like a freshwater tarpon, but if it had, you know, unprotected sex with an alligator gar, you know, something quite odd. You know, they've got these sort of elongated flat heads, and their eyes are almost upturned, you know, so it sits almost on top of the head, which allows them to hunt from below and ambush, because they're sitting on the bottom for a big part of the day, and anything that swims past just gets sucked in. So obviously it's a very long fish, much like a tarpon, with big scales. What is really cool is they fight almost like a tarpon. Once they're hooked, they will go almost immediately airborne and do these massive side-to-side head shakes. They're obviously not as strong and as fast as tarpon, but it is similar in a lot of ways. And then obviously the red scales is something that makes them extremely beautiful fish. If you catch the fish in later in the season, sort of towards the end of end of May, they start picking up this very bright, vivid red coloration, especially on the bottom jaw and all the way along the belly when they're going into spawning colors. And that is really exceptionally beautiful.
And they're sometimes able to come up for air.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's something important that I missed. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that they had to breathe air, we'd probably never catch these things. The air breathing is a massive part of the fishing, and it is a massive part of how we locate them. So obviously they're in low oxygenated water and it's murky and dark, but they will come up, depending on the size of the fish, between 8 and 10 minutes apart. So these fish will come up to the surface, make a big gulp of air, and roll back down. And they actually have a pseudo lung, which allows them to breathe, you know, normal air. And because they do this, we can actually see where a fish is and which way it's heading and how quickly it's swimming. And this is where the guides are so good at their jobs. You'll see a fish roll and they'll tell you exactly, okay, it's moving from left to right. It is moving more or less that fast. Look at the last bubble. I want you to cast 1.5 meters ahead of the last bubble. And, you know, that should have, you know, line you up with a fish. And there's a big anticipation game when you're fishing for Arapaima, because it's in some ways like you're sight fishing to them, but you're not actually seeing the fish. You're sight fishing to their signs, you know, the things that give them away. And it is amazing because you're casting into basically black water and just waiting for that massive eat to come as you're stripping in.
That's pretty cool, especially I imagine in those jungle surroundings where so much will seem new and unique to people who are visiting. To have that experience from a fish has got to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think the Arapaima eat is probably, out of all the fish that I've caught, it's got to be the most exciting and most exhilarating eat out of all of them.
Wow. And you've done a lot. That says a lot.
Sorry, there's another call here.
That's okay. For those who are listening,
sorry for that. We might have to cut that bit out.
I don't know if we do. I don't know if we do or not. But if we can't cut it out, this part of the conversation is going to stay too. So I guess that'll just be entertaining.
I apologize to the audience.
No, we're always calling around the world, so it's part of the game.
Yeah. So you know, you've seen these videos of Jaco Lucas feeding the Arapaima in like a little pen.
Yeah.
And if you see, you know, the gill plates flare out and these fish lunge out to grab the bait. So obviously they're accustomed to that, but when they're feeding in their natural environment, that's exactly what happens, you know. You'll often see an entire column of water come up and just boil and swirl as they eat. So you can literally physically hear the gill plates flare. And in the film, you'll hear the guide say, you know, hear that tuk, you know, that sucking noise. And that's a real thing. It's pretty amazing to witness that.
Wow. That's cool. I guess I have to be honest here. I have a film that I produced that I was one of the producers for in the Fly Fishing Film Tour this year. But I have not watched it. I have not watched the films yet.
It's definitely worth a watch. There's some good stuff in there. Well,
for those who perhaps haven't seen any of these films, let's talk about yours. So the Rewild Rodeo. What's it about?
So the film is basically the story of Rewa. It's pretty much what we've spoken about up to now, and it tells the story of conservation. So as with any good fishing film, there's a lot of fish born, and it's exciting, and there's a lot of explosive jumps and head shakes and all that. And it's great. But what makes the film special for me is the interviews with the team. And especially there's one interview with Winston Edwards, and he is the head researcher for Arapaima. And he tells a story of how he used to kill fish and how he used to enjoy it because he didn't know better. And now he's the guy, you know, inserting the pit tags into the fish. He's the guy measuring the fish, writing down the information, making sure the fish are okay. And you can see how this guy has completely changed, like 180 degrees, and he's doing the exact opposite of what he used to. And I think that's a cool part of the story.
That's great. It's something that I've always wanted to see some more of is people within the indigenous communities at IndieFly sites speaking more about their experience. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
It's fun. I mean, they're fun people that speak very, serviceable English. You know, you can understand what they're saying, and it's cool to see their take on it because I don't think they've been given a voice for a very long time, and it's nice to hear how passionate they are about it.
Good. The trailer for your film is available on Vimeo and YouTube under the Fly Fishing Film Tours accounts, and it's on your Instagram and IndieFly's Instagram and elsewhere too. And so, in the trailer, you can see a lot of exciting footage too. So it's got something for everybody. But I recommend everyone goes and watches this film, and I will, of course, too. I just haven't yet. And it's being it this year because of COVID. It's a virtual fly fishing film tour, and so I believe tickets can be purchased at fly shops to help support fly shops, but also directly through the film tour on their website.
Yeah, it's a pretty good initiative.
So, what's the longest stretch of time you've spent at Rewa?
The longest stint, it's actually very easy going in terms of spending a lot of time, because the season is broken up into two parts, and it's revolving around the dry season. So, I'm going to have to thumb suck and say it's, I think, 2.5 months that I've spent at Rewa.
Wow.
Somewhere around 10 weeks, more or less, which really doesn't feel like much. It's a very comfortable place to stay. The food is good. People are friendly. The Wi-Fi connection is even worse than mine right now, but that's about the worst of it.
The Costa, a number of years ago, made an animated video short about Rewa, and it really highlighted how much this ecosystem has to offer, especially with species diversity. What are some of the unique creatures you've seen aside from arapaima in this area?
Well, we can talk about fish all day, but I'll skip that for now. You've got these giant river otters that come in little packs. You know, they'll make a pack of like 10 or 12 or whatever. And if you hit the side of the boat and make little noises, they'll literally come and investigate, you know, like, who's here? You know, what are you doing in our territory? And it's really cool. It's actually, you can see it in the film in the introduction or like the opening scenes. There's like a little clip of these otters coming in and looking at the boat. And you've got capybara, which is the world's largest rodent, harpy eagles, which is one hell of a bird. We've got macaws and a whole variety of beautiful jungle birds. You know, it's incredible to just look around. Basically, every morning you get woken up by howler monkeys, which is quite frightening, to be honest. I would not go into the jungle at night by myself. It literally sounds like a metal band without the music. It's just the most vicious growling you've ever heard in your life.
That's funny. And howler... Speaking of Howler, Howler the Brothers, the company, made a limited series of, I think, shirts and hats with a certain type of toad that's unique to the area.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, it's a little frog. To be honest, I'm not too, I can't tell exactly what it is. It's a tiny little frog. It's about the size of a pinky nail that you find at Kaitir Falls, which is, I think, the biggest single drop in Guyana. And it's endemic to that specific area. So we don't actually see them at Rewa. But Howler decided to pick the little frog because it's just so unique. And it's not as obvious as putting an Arapaima on a gaucho shirt, which is cool. I think it's a beautiful shirt.
I do too. I recently saw on Instagram that you were auctioning off some of your art. It was an Arapaima piece with proceeds benefiting the lodge and the community down there. And I've been paying attention to your art for some time. I love your art. I don't know quite how to describe it. So I'm really gonna, you know, throw the microphone over to you because I'd really like you to talk about it. I joked with you when we weren't recording that I've been trying to write interview questions about your art for you for some time, but don't even know where to begin. So let's talk about your art. I need you to take the lead on this one.
Okay, I'll try my best. The Rewa piece was really something cool for me. Obviously, Arapaima are beautiful fish, and they are kind of intriguing to draw, you know. So not being able to go to Rewa was really tough. And I think the people of Rewa obviously felt the, you know, I wouldn't say the lack of income, because they're subsistence farmers, and they do fine for themselves. But obviously, there was a massive gap with not having clients coming through to the lodge, and the fishing was standing still. Nobody was coming in, and obviously I couldn't be there. So I decided to paint a big Arapaima. It's about a 40 by 30 inch piece that I did in pen and watercolor. And yeah, we ended up auctioning it off on Instagram, and all the money went straight to Rewa. Sort of like a little cash injection for them, just to say, hey, we're thinking about you and we'll be back. It was something really cool that I'm happy we did. And yeah, I think it was a pretty good success.
I think so too. So most of your art is through drawing, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, it's usually like pen drawings or sketches that I sometimes work some color into, usually watercolor or pencil, but it's mostly like a black and white sketch art.
And so you've done everything from giant trevally to redfish to Arapaima. There's an Arapaima post that you posted recently on Instagram.
Yeah.
And so it seems like your passion for fish species comes out a lot in your art.
Yeah. I mean, I've been very privileged to guide in multiple destinations that offer multiple species, and it's become a bit of a thing to try and catch as many fish as I can. It's almost like, you know, Jeff Currier having caught like 400 species or whatever, you know. And a lot of these fish are really pretty, and that's what I try and do. I'll try and capture as many species, both on fly and with the art. So it's been really cool. Obviously, some fish I haven't caught yet, like the redfish, but it's something that I think people relate to. And when I get a chance, I'll go and catch one of them as well.
And like Currier, you also willing to put some of your art on fly boxes? And
oh yeah,
that's great. Do you get a lot of requests for that?
Yeah, too many. You know, it's usually like somebody on location, like, hey, Johan, just quickly draw me an Arapaima on the box. I'm like, dude, that's going to take me like 5 or 6 hours. You got to, you know, give me a heads up. Like, it's kind of difficult, you know. But when I've got the free time, you know, obviously now during COVID, I had a lot of free time. So, yeah, the drawing was a big part of my income for the last year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Where can folks go to learn more about you and your art?
Well, pretty much Instagram. I think that's where you'll see everything, and it's ongoing, and there's always something new coming through. I'm working on getting a website up and running, and that's going to be exciting because it's going to be like a virtual gallery where you can just go and look at everything all at once. But yeah, Instagram pretty much tells the whole story.
And your handle is Johan Dupree's_art.
That's it.
That's it. It's, I think if you're a Flangler and you start searching, if you're not already following him, it'll come up pretty quickly. Because
yeah, it should.
And, I'd be looking forward to seeing your artwork, on a website. But I also would love to chat more just about the fact that you've, been to so many destinations, guided so many species and been all over the world. So I'd love to have you back. Thank you.
That would be awesome.
Thank you for coming on to talk about Rewa and your new film. And again, I encourage everybody, as I will also, to go check out all the films in the Fly Fishing Film Tour.
Yeah, I mean, the films this year are incredible. Definitely worth a watch. Tim, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you.